Either she homeless or she got problems. That's the only reason why she run to a black man.
I like him already.
Now you wanna get nuts? Come on!
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome...
Producer, director, writer. He is the ultimate filmmaker and bona fide foodie. You're listening to The Quiddituzz Factor with Michael J. Arbouet.
Hi there, howdy, greetings, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Quiddituzz Factor. I am your host, Michael J. Arbouet. But that word, that Latin word, quiddituzz, what does it mean?
Quiditas, Latin, the whatness of a thing, the essential nature of something, the quality that makes a thing what it is.
Yes, quiditas is the whatness of the essence of a thing or person. And in this episode, I'm going to be talking to an actor who is determined. And when I say determined, he's never given up. He has always done things to make himself better. He slowly climbed up the ladder, and he's like in everything. When I think about the word determination, a quote by Thomas Hopkins comes to mind, and that quote is, "I'm not judged by the numbers of times I fall, but by the numbers of time I succeed, and the number of times I succeed is in direct proportion to the number of times I fail and keep trying." And that's what this person has done magnificently throughout his career. The person I'm talking about is actor, producer, and director Kelly O'Coin. When I think about Kelly, think about that movie, Glengarry Glen Ross, Always Be Closing. That's what Kelly does. He's been in a ton of things. If you watch television as much as I do, you've seen him in things such as The Slap, Unforgettable, Persons of Interest, The Following, Elementary. The list goes on and on. But you also might have seen him in his recurring roles, such as Pastor Tim in The Americans, or The House of Cards, or my favorite, Billions, as Dollar Bill. Kelly's drive and determination is amazing, and it reminds me of this quote by Napoleon Hill, and that quote is, "Victory is always possible for the person who refuses to stop fighting," and that's what Kelly has done. He's refused to stop fighting. He's always creating and always honing his craft. So let's get into this episode. So without further ado, let's welcome to the show Kelly O'Coin. Hey, Kelly, buddy, how you doing?
It's going well. I haven't seen you in forever, man.
I know. It's been crazy. So we've known each other for years. Well, I first met you when I worked in my brother's film when I produced his first film, Serial. But I don't actually know about your origin story. So what I like to do with all my guests is say, let's go back to when you were 8, 9 years old. Kelly O'Coin, did you always want to be an actor at that age? Did you know what your dream was going to be?
You know, it's interesting. I don't know that I put words to it until a little bit later. But by the time I was always acting, my mom was a singer. My sister actually acted early on too. And like when we were really young, and has a beautiful singing voice. She still sings, not professionally, but she's great. And then my dad was in politics. So, you know, I always joke that I'm not sure if you're familiar with the fact that if you're aware of the fact that there's a certain performative aspect to politics. But you know, I saw him in front of crowds, and I was used to being sort of on display. You know, one of the things that politicians do is they show off their families to people, and I got to like that. I like the energy of interacting with people. I loved watching my dad give speeches, and I knew some of the speeches were written verbatim, and I was like, wow, you can really bring I wasn't thinking in these words, but in retrospect, I realized I was impressed that he could bring a script alive. And then he could also I saw him give speeches that just had bullet points and you know, interact with people in town hall meetings, which he had constantly, like once a month. And in retrospect, I realized I was responding to that because it's improv, you know, and it's not, I mean, people sometimes laugh or smirk when they talk about the performative nature of politics. And yes, it can be, and is so often these days, it can be such, it can be a rather evil aspect to it, you know, when they're pulling things over on people. But at its base, you have to connect. to people. You have to inspire. And part of that is your personality. I mean, I have people now, and we can get into politics all we want, but I have, and I'm a progressive, and I'm going to vote for whoever is running against Donald Trump. And I'm going to work for whoever's running against Donald Trump. And I have a lot of progressive friends who are like, Joe Biden just doesn't inspire me. And I know that some of it, he's more conservative than a lot of us might want, but I don't really, if you can't get inspired to get a dictator in the making out of office, then, you know, I don't know what to say to you. But that said, I'm strafing here. But that said, it sort of speaks to, you know, Obama was a little more conservative than any of us who voted for him, progressives who voted for him, wanted to admit, because there was something about the way he inspired us that, I guess, for lack of a better word, made up for that. Anyway, and I love the guy, but I'm just talking about the performative nature. Anyway, that was my little defense of performance in politics. What was the question again? No, so right. I really apparently don't want to answer this question. So I grew up comfortable with that, and I just started getting into plays early on. There weren't a lot of boys that went out for the choir, for instance, in grade school. That was where musical plays were cast. And then I just sort of, I was so into it that I think I committed fully at an age when a lot of kids are sort of shy about being on stage. I was just like, ah, here I am. And that let me get better because I kept doing it. And then early in junior high, I knew I wanted to be an actor, but I didn't know who to tell. I didn't know anybody would become an actor. I didn't know if anyone would laugh at me. I didn't know if it was ridiculous. And had no idea what the path would be. But then in high school, there was a botany teacher in my sophomore year who also sang and acted. And I admitted it to him. And he's like, oh, I think you can make it. And he was the first guy who'd actually done some professional acting, who had tons of friends in New York, theater actors who were making it, who told me, I think you can make it. And that just blew my mind. So the answer, I guess, I think latently, yes. Like I knew I wanted to be an actor, but it took a while to actually put words to it.
So once you found your calling and you kind of figured out that you really truly wanted to be an actor, is this something that you studied in college?
I did not. I grappled with this. I was just trying to decide between going to like a conservatory environment, like say Northwestern, or a liberal arts college. And ultimately that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to go to a liberal arts college. So I went to Oberlin in Ohio. And I think one of the benefits of being in at a school like that is that you can take all the acting classes you want. You can do all the productions you want, as long as you get cast in those classes and cast in those plays. You don't have to be a major. The major included a lot of really, really late hours, hanging lights and building costumes and things that I probably should have learned more about early on. I have since. But I also was interested in history, which is what my major ended up being. I was also interested in philosophy, and I was interested in some of these religion courses they were teaching, origins of religion, which were in a lot of ways philosophy classes. And I wanted that liberal arts education. And so it was great for me. I didn't have to major in it. And I still got the type of education and that I wanted. I will say that it doing it that way and compounded with not going to grad school for acting didn't mean that I was going to be a worse actor in the long run, but it did mean, for me anyway, that I didn't make the connections that would have helped me land something solid, or at least get in some doors earlier. It took me a lot longer to make any connections, because those are the places where you start to make connections. So there were pluses and minuses, but overall, I'm glad with the way I did it, and I feel like I got a more well-rounded education.
A lot of actors email me and they ask me to ask the actors that I interview how they got their agent. So I have to ask you, how did you get your first agent?
It took me forever. Can I swear on this? I forgot to ask you that.
Yeah. Okay.
It took me for fucking ever, to be more exact. It's such a, and I know things are so different now. The way everything works is different now, but it was the kind of thing where it was this weird roundabout push me, pull you, catch 22. How do you get an agent? Well, you got to get a show so they can see you. Well, how do you get a show? Well, it helps to have an agent. Well, okay, how do I know what's out there? Can I see the breakdowns? No, you need an agent for that. It's like, well, how do I get an agent? Well, we can get a show. And it just, it was really hard. When I moved to Los Angeles and I did a play, there was a manager who was the wife of a guy in the show, and she happened to be looking for someone my age for a soap opera. role. And so I went in, and she was like, and it was a great audition, and she's like, I'd like to work with you, this was a great audition, I got great feedback. I didn't get it because I was like 8 years too old or something, and this was when I was in my 20s, so I don't know why they brought me. but I started working for her. I got maybe two auditions from her. I kind of blew every one of them. I didn't know what I was doing. I'm looking back on it, I was almost like apologetic, not in words, but in attitude. I was very back-footed about everything. I was just like, thank you so much for letting me in, this is really a pleasure, I just want to watch. And it's like, well, no, you're auditioning. Oh, right. Oh, okay. And I couldn't make strong choices. I kept trying to figure out what people wanted me to do with a capital D, as opposed to just fucking doing something and making it your own. And and gradually I remember even one time I was trying to talk to, I wanted so badly to talk to the manager about what's going on. How do I fix, there just seems like there's a stasis. I don't know. And so I called her, or maybe I can't remember if I was in the room or not. And I was just like, I'd love to have a sit down meeting with you and about something. And it took me forever to work up the courage to ask her this, which is stupid. It's your manager. And she's like, okay, cool. What about? And I was like, well, you know, stuff in general. And she's like, no, I don't have time for stuff in general. What's the agenda? And then, you know, my heart was in my mouth, and I just stuttered about something. And then I don't think I ever even set up the meeting. And then I lost the manager. So, you know, that was my first foray. She never signed me. Then I went and did regional theater for a huge number of years, including the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, which is a fantastic theater. Won a Tony for best regional theater a few years ago. And after I was done there, moved to New York and did a lot of little plays because I made some connections there. And these managers that a friend of mine were with liked theater, like little theater. They knew about the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. I showed them some quotes I had, you know, some good reviews. And they're like, let's try it. This was October. Let's try it to the end of the year. And I had, like that November, I think I had, to this day, the best ratio of auditions to callbacks that I've ever had in my life. And I don't think I booked anything, but in their minds, they were like, look, you get called back. Or even if you get called by a week after you auditioned for one casting director, you get called in by that same casting director for another show. That's a callback to me. Because that means you have, that means you've impressed somebody, you've shown somebody that you can work, that you're diligent on. Anyway, so I because of that month, they ended up signing me, and I was with them for like 18 years. I have different representation now, but that's sort of how it happened.
So I have to ask you, you know, we met years ago in the early 2000s. I produced my brother's film Serial. And it was a low budget, you know, nightmare. No, it was a good film. But I have to ask, you know, I interviewed Eric Jensen a couple of weeks ago, and I have to ask you the same question. You know, why did you do our dinky little film for such low money? What was the appeal?
Well, I mean, like, think about it. I mean, it's still the case now. Like, sometimes the smallest productions are the most interesting, because if you read a script and you really dig it, then you're going to be inclined to do it no matter what. A number of factors with that one. It was great script, great concept, like you say. And we can just describe to the listeners what that was. Although if they're listening to you, you guys probably talked about it with Eric. the found footage thing. I loved the vibe as soon as I went into the room. I mean, also, I hadn't done that many films at the time. I was doing a lot of theater, but still not even getting paid much for theater. Like, I knew that I had skill. I knew that I had enough of a sense that, okay, I'm good. That it wasn't that I was, you know, lost in my career or anything, but I just hadn't made much money. So doing a movie, any movie, and it's still the case, movies are harder to get. You see actors who are stars on TV who play tiny little roles in interesting movies just because they want to be part of the script. So anyway, so it was a great script. I went into the room and the vibe was just great. Were you there at that first audition?
I wasn't there at the first audition. I was there, I think, at the second, and for the table read when the whole cast came together.
Okay. Because I don't remember going in a second time. I think I was just there once and then the table read. But because I remember meeting you on set, but we must have met at the table read. But the vibe in the room was great. LJ and Kevin were just, like, they were just nice, you know, but not like cloyingly so, not like LA nice. It was actually like just nice. Hey, how you doing? It's great. Let's do this. Hey. We talked about the character a little bit, and I had a level of comfort. So which was unusual for me at the time. And I was just like, I got like so many ways this character can go. I got a few ideas. Can I give you like two different takes, two different like ideas about it? And they're like, sure. And we did one, and that felt like a good sign. It was a good sign I was comfortable enough to ask. It was a good sign that they said yes. We did the first one, and I remember they were great. They responded so well. They were like, that was great. I loved it. And then they were saying, well, this is great to see you. I'll meet you. And I was like, wait, can I give my other take? And they're like, oh, yeah. And we did that in the second version with the hint of the psychotic thing was the way we ended up playing it more in the movie. But it just felt like we were working. You know, and so I got excited. It was still a new enough experience for me, and it felt like a really fun collaborative environment. People liked to laugh, people liked to mix it up, you know. There were a lot of intense people. Eric's an intense dude, but he and I had a great time sort of not improvising exactly, but like riffing off of things every once in a while, and you guys were open to that. Throwing new things. Kevin was throwing new things at us every once in a while. It was just, it felt alive and kinetic. And there's always a magic to that. And so that was my take on it. I didn't think of it. I thought it was a really smart, fascinating. I want to think of another example, but I can't. So I'm just going to say little engine that could kind of movie, you know. I had a great time.
One of the things that was exciting to me is that after you did our film, maybe like a year, 2 years later, I started to catch you in all these different things. And one of the first times I saw you on screen was in that movie, Jewel and Julia. Tell me about that.
So Julia and Julia. I think I had 5 lines, ended up with maybe 3 in the movie. It was, you know, it's like I said, it's hard to get movie jobs. I did The Post recently, ironically another Meryl Streep movie. And I had, it was a whole scene. I think I had 2 lines left in the movie. And there was a whole scene in the Supreme Court at the end that was just cut, and all of us had a little bit in that, and that was gone. You know, David Costable, who plays Wags in Billions, had maybe 4 lines. You know, like, just people, it's harder to get movies. You want to be a part of these things. And you, so anyway, I just went in and auditioned. I remember Nora Ephron, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I went in, auditioned for her. It was really fun. She's a hero. So it was really fun to meet her. She had a bandage over on her face because she just recently had a surgery or something, and so that felt so strange, but it humanized the room a little bit. And this again was a little bit earlier on in my career, so I stuff like that really helped. And she was so effusive that I was like, well, I booked the shit out of that. And then I didn't hear anything for 2 months, and it was like, oh, I guess I didn't get it. there was another movie at the time about Dillinger, and it was a Chicago movie. There was a virulently vicious cop, Chicago cop, that I was on hold for like a month, and I was within a 24-hour period, I was told I didn't get that, but can you be on the set of Julia and Julia tomorrow? Because they need to replace somebody. I found out that the guy who had been in Julia and Julia left to do the gig that I was waiting on in Dillinger. Wow. It was a much bigger role. It was like, you know, 2 weeks of work and all that, but still. Yeah, so that's how it happened. It was fun. A friend of mine, the three of us, the Houghton Mifflin publishers who reject her book, stupidly reject her book, Julia Child's book. There were three of us, and one of them was a good friend of mine. So he and I had a great time hanging out on set. I goofily, it sounds funny for someone who'd been acting for 20 years already, but I had just two little interactions with Meryl Streep, and she adjusted so completely to all my little different takes with each time we did it, that I was like, hey, I'm having an effect on Meryl Streep. And then he said, yeah, you mean you guys are acting? But there was something about it. It's such a surreal experience to play a role that is so tiny like that, in a way. I mean, it's great. It's its own thing. There's nothing wrong with it, but it's just odd. It doesn't feel like your normal type of acting where you've got interaction and you've got a bunch of dialogue and you've got an arc. So in that sort of surreal realm, semi outside of acting, the fact that I would do something and Meryl would change what she did and respond to me. And it was just like, it was almost like a weird little game of Pong. And it was really fun. I was giddy about it. I mean, I don't relish playing tiny roles, but it was certainly a feather in my cap to be a part of it. You know, just like being a part of The Post. Those are movies you just want to be a part of.
So I'm going to switch things up a little bit, because I know being an actor is very difficult and it's a hard profession to live with. So I have to ask you this question. How did you meet your wife?
How did I meet my wife?
Yes.
All right. I was at Oberlin College. I graduated credit short. I think I graduated 2 credits short, maybe a credit and a half. And at Oberlin, you can walk with your class at the ceremony if you are within 3 credits of graduating, even though you haven't graduated. So I got a diploma that said, please return at the end of the ceremony. It didn't say, congratulations, graduate. It said, please return. And so the next semester, I went back to Oberlin. I'd finished my major in history, but I took a bowling class, which was a PE credit, mm-hmm. And I did a play, which was a theater credit. And that's all I needed. So as this, it might not be incredibly surprising to hear that a person who sort of couldn't graduate on time might forget things. And one of the things I forgot as I drove into town, I realized was, oh shit, I didn't arrange housing. So I had a Volkswagen bus and I was sleeping. I was crashing at some friends' places every once in a while, but I was sleeping in the back of my bus. And I met Carolyn. The first time I met her, I was at a soccer game. We were watching a soccer game with a friend of mine. And I met this really cool woman. And we were chatting. And as I was leaving to go, I turned to wave to my friend who was sitting next to her up in the bleachers. And she was sitting there. And I just remember thinking, huh, like there was something just so bing about that moment. And I have a photograph of it because I snapped a photo of my friend and she's there on the side. And then that night I went to a party at someone's house and she was on the porch and she said, howdy, literally said howdy, which was kind of adorable. She was sitting on the banister and no one was talking to her at that moment. She had a cup, you know, like you pay $1 and you get a cup so you can fill it with beer, fill your cup with beer. I got a free cup. I didn't have to spend $1. She gave me her cup. We chatted for like 3 hours, and then a couple nights later, and I told her where how I was living, how I was sleeping, and she thought that was ludicrous. And then a couple nights later, was passing by her and her friend, who were like, "Are you going to a parking lot somewhere? What's going on?" And I said, "Yes." And they're like, "Crash with us." And so I slept on their couch for 3 nights in a row, and then the third night, Carolyn and I kissed, and we've been together ever since.
You know, the reason why I asked you that question is because I was wondering, you know, as you get more successful, how do you juggle your private life with your, you know, professional life? You know, being an actor and, you know, going to sets every once in a while and being away for weeks or months at a time. How do you deal with that?
I mean, I don't know. She actually travels more than I do. She's a dancer. She won awards back in the day. She still dances, but she's also a historical marine ecologist. You know, that old cliche. And she also teaches communicating science. So she's traveled for all of those things. She was actually leading a class in, co-leading a class, of college students, in, Greece and, Romania last summer for 5 weeks. So she was gone for 6 weeks, you know. She travels to, she was teaching stuff pretty regularly in University of Arizona and, in New Hampshire and, at NASA in Cleveland, you know, to, like just helping scientists figure out how to better communicate. And then for a long time, she would dance. She'd be gone for like 2 months in Germany one time, and then 3 months in Germany, and then dancing in Portugal and all that stuff. So I think the good thing is that we both understood that aspect of the creative life, mm-hmm. and there's still creativity in teaching too. So I'm including that. But the good thing also was that we weren't both actors. So there was no kind of measurable way to compare ourselves. So I don't think the jealousies, potential jealousies, or competition ever popped up. We're both very independent people and like our alone time, and are great when we're together. And I think we both got lucky that's the case for both of us. And when we go away, there's always a little bit of a sense of like, you grow a little bit when you go away and you're with other people by yourself, and you're allowed to, not allowed, but it's the growth is more inherent when you are not with your partner, you know, the other half of you, you grow more, and then you bring that back to the whole. And I mean, we don't sit around saying that every time we go away. It's not like, honey, I hope you meet a lot of people and then bring back your experiences so that we can, but that's how we kind of live. I think the idea that like when she tells me her stories or sends pictures or whatever, I mean, eat that stuff up. It's fascinating. Right. And that's fodder for a good relationship when you guys, you know, if nothing's ever new, like she's like, "Hey, I went to the thing and did that." I'm like, "Yeah, I know. I was with you about everything we do." That to me is kind of boring.
Right.
So, hours can sometimes get hard. The way her work, both with dance and with teaching and science, they generally know exactly what they're doing way ahead of time. And for me, until Billions and somewhat The Americans, but I was recurring there. I wasn't a regular. So with Billions, I'm just like, all right, for this 6 months, I'm at their beck and call. So we never plan anything. But when it's not Billions time, and particularly when I was freelance everywhere, it was really hard to plan. And we would never, you know, we spent fortunes on tickets because they were always last minute when I finally realized I was free. And we learned, I think my dad was like, you know, you're going to pay less probably. Buy the ticket early, and then you're going to pay less in fines by changing it. But you know, live and learn. but that's a challenge. Like getting alone time, the two of us going away together can be kind of a challenge.
So that kind of led into my next question that I wanted to ask you. I noticed as you got more and more work that you were a series regular on The Americans and House of Cards and Turn. Can you tell the audience, and for those actors who wanted to know, what's the difference between a series regular and a recurring role?
Yeah, so my understanding is that it's a lot different now than it used to be. where there were a lot more series regulars. It doesn't necessarily have a lot. It doesn't necessarily dictate how much screen time you're going to get or how many storylines you're going to get, because there are a lot of recurring characters who have the best storylines and who are on all the time. There's some people who are recurring and have all episodes guaranteed that they're going to be on. I mean, they're going to get paid for it, whether or not they're used, which to me is like, well, that sort of sounds like a series regular. Because normally it's a recurring character, a recurring actor will have, generally speaking, fewer story arcs. You probably get a guarantee. Let's say the new industry standard is 12 episodes. For the Americans, for a few seasons, I had 7 guaranteed episodes, and for Billions, I had the same. Even though we were sort of told, probably not with the Americans, but with Billions, probably a lot more. But I think there have only been 4 episodes over the course of the whole run of the series that I have not been on. But when you are bumped up to series regular, there's a little bit more money. Although it's a lot less than it used to be back in the day. I was sort of shocked. and you are guaranteed you will be paid for every episode, no matter whether or not you're in it.
Right.
And when you're recurring, it can fluctuate. But it gets a little gray, you know. The guy who plays Ari Spiros on Billions, Steve Kunkin, is a recurring character, but he's in every episode, and he has as much to do as I do. He also is on Handmaid's Tale with a nice recurring role, similar to what I was doing size-wise, I suppose, with the Americans. So maybe that was a choice not to be series regular. Maybe he was offered that and said, I'm going to keep my options open so that I can go back and forth. Because once you are a series regular, they really own your time. They are number one. They're in first position when you're making any choices about other gigs. I'm lucky that the Billions people are wonderful at working with me so that I can, and the other productions, so that I can do things. I've been able to do The Bold Type a few times, which is a recurring character I started, and that's really fun. Playing like a nice father, it's such an antidote to play. I love Dollar Bill, but oh my God, he's an asshole. He's such a toxic asshole. So it's nice to play just a sweet father, you know, in The Bold Type. And then I got to do a couple movies over the last fall and early winter before lockdown. And that's because these guys work with the other producers and show and assistant directors and make it happen. But they don't have to. Mm-hmm. They could be like, you know what? I don't know. Maybe there's going to be a rainstorm and we're going to need to switch the schedule around. And, you know, we pay you, so you're going to be here. So it's great. To me, it's something that I wanted to be a regular on this show too. Wanted to be a series regular, so I said yes, but I thought it was worth it.
Another show that you were on, and I kind of feel funny that I didn't recognize you in this either, was Intern. Tell me about that show.
another wig show.
Wig. But I mean, that was a completely period piece, so it took me a while to figure out it was you.
And if you look at those wigs, they're actually really weirdly similar. It's almost like Pastor Tim was a revolutionary spy. Like, this was great grandfather, Hercules Mulligan Tim. So, no, that was really fun too. And that was, but interestingly, that was another one where there was more and it was cut down a little bit. Like, there was one scene in the prison that was like a really fun back and forth and just like this power struggle. And there was a lot more that my character got to do, and that just got sort of axed, but that happens, you know. And I was, and then they added something later, so that there were a lot of New York theater actor friends of mine on that show, so that was really fun to go down to Richmond. And, you know, I grew up part of my life in DC, so DC, Richmond, all that stuff is an interesting place to visit. I'd love to go back now, given how things have been changing. I'd love to see. I remember. Okay, here one of my first. After I left the Oregon, I'm strafing again. After I left the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, I had a long dry spell, and I did this play called Arcadia, which was one of my favorite plays at the time. Tom Stoppard. It was at Theater Virginia, which is now defunct, but it was a really good, reputable regional theater, and it was a beautiful space, and that felt like my reemergence, and I loved being down there. And there was an area of Richmond that was really wonderful and multicultural, and like a really cool area that we were living in. And then I took a long walk, and I came across this avenue called Monument Avenue, and I was like, "What now?" And so it's been really interesting to me and exciting to see how people have approached that avenue in recent months. I really there's some amazing photography. I haven't been down there, but there's some amazing shots of the protests and the artwork, the defiant art that has been that is surrounding those statues.
So Turn and House of Cards, both politically driven shows. Do you think that your father being a politician helped you in those roles?
No, because House of Cards, I was like the only non-political guy. I was like, it was so funny. There was a period of time. I don't think I've ever really played a politician in a major production. And I played this. So I was Michael Kelly's brother, Stamper's brother, in season 3, which was great. I mean, in the sense that it was like Michael Kelly's season. Like, he got his first Emmy nomination, I think, for the series on that. And Stamper was coming back from almost, you know, being hit on the head and almost dying. And you're feeling a lot of sympathy for him, even though you think about it, it's like, well, he almost killed someone. That's why he got it. Anyway, so I don't know anything about this. I just come and I'm as his brother, and I'm nursing him back. Helping nurse him back to life and get him away from booze, which is what I think his problem is. So I had like 4 episodes, and it was all just with him. I didn't really get to know the production. I got to meet obviously Bo Willimon, and then any director who worked that week, but mainly it was just Michael Kelly. And I love that guy. I love him. He was incredibly supportive. I happened to get the, He figures in my origin story, my Dollar Bill Billions origin story, because I had auditioned for a different character on Billions while I was shooting House of Cards. And I know it went well, but they called me back, and it was a recurring character. They said that it wasn't quite right for that one, but here, would he come back in and read this role? And it was like not actually, didn't even say possible recur. It was just like 5 lines. It's like, you know, I don't want to do that anymore. I want something that's got at least a possibility for growth. And then I was talking to him about it, and I just happened to mention it. I was like, yes, character Dollar Bill, he's the cheapest millionaire in America. And but you know, I'm not gonna do those types of roles anymore, as if I knew what the type of role was. And he was like, yeah, you know, it's like, Brian Koppelman and David Levine, you know, they're pretty good, like, guys. Like, they write good shit. They do Ocean's 13, you know, they did Rounders. And he was like, Paul Giamatti and Damian Lewis are in it? I don't know, man. I go in, don't do the pilot. And then if it doesn't seem like it's going to build, maybe, you know, you don't have to stay with it. You're not being locked in for 5 years. That's not exactly how the conversation went, but those would be the ideas that he kind of, in our conversation, those ideas bubbled up. And so I contacted my people, and I was like, if it's not too late, I'd like to go in. And they're like, okay, we'll come in tomorrow. And I did. And it went great. And I remember, the showrunners were like, you're in House of Cards. And I said, yeah. And they're like, what's the role? I was like, I can't tell you. And then there was a look on their face. They didn't actually say this, but there was a look on one of their faces, and it was almost like, if you don't tell me, I'm not going to hire you. So I was like, okay, I play Snapper's brother. But anyway, that's again long. Slightly connected things, but I will always be thankful to Michael, because just again, I don't think he was actually saying you should do it. I think it was just the conversation we had led me to realize, with his help, that I should go in, and and the role really turned into something.
So let's talk Billions, season 1, episode 10. I believe the episode was called Quality of Life. In that episode, Dollar Bill fakes a fight with his boss. That was such a great scene. Tell me about that.
Season 1, and this fake fight, it was, I howled when I read that. And I think it was the first time I realized that, all right, they really... they're interested in seeing what I can do. They're interested in seeing what Dollar Bill can become. Karin Kusama, by the way, I don't know if you know her, but she's one of the best directors working out there now, film directors. And she was shooting the episode. She did Girl Fight and The Invitation. And she's fucking incredible. I wish she was on Twitter, because I'd be shouting her out all the time. She directed that episode, and it was just so much fun working with her. She actually has directed two of the best episodes of Billions. There's so many that I love, but the Ice Juice episode, which was a big heist, it played out like a heist movie, and then the one with the fake fight. She's great. Anyway, thank you. That's awesome. And that was a pivotal episode for me. And I'm sure that the fact that it went well helped them have confidence to grow the character to the extent that they have.
So these next couple of questions are the questions that the audience love to hear the answers to. They're like my patent podcast questions. So my first question to you is, what's something that people seem to misunderstand about you?
I've been learning that people think I'm rich.
Yeah, I would think that too, with all the recurring roles you've had,
which is hilarious. Yeah, I think that that's a really good question. I don't know. I haven't been presented that often with people saying things like, or even attitude wise, but presenting me with, well, that's so you. I think there was a period of time where people thought I'm a relatively irreverent person, and I can be goofy, and I, as much as I like to be serious, I think those other elements, being quippy, being goofy, those are types of things that bind us together. I think they're important. I think they solidify relationships, family relationships, friendship relationships, everything. And sometimes people, I think, for a while thought I wasn't a serious person. I also appreciate self-deprecating humor, because it's so, unless I really know that person, I don't want to slam them, unless they're being an asshole. But, you know, you're an easy target. And I remember my dad, at one point my dad was like, I think that you're too self-deprecating. You shouldn't do that. I think it gives other people a negative impression of you. Which I ultimately disagreed with, but it was a good thing to at least examine, whether or not that was true, and whether or not, and to his credit, there's no discredit there. That's a perfectly valid way of looking at things. But, as a father and a friend, 'cause we are great friends too, it's very possible that he also just wondered if I had a low self-esteem, and if it could be a self-fulfilling prophecy where I'm making fun of myself. Do I start thinking ill of myself, which isn't true, but, you know, bless him for thinking that. So I don't know. Beyond that, maybe those are the two things.
Quiditas is the whatness or essence of a thing or person. But being that that's such a hard word to understand, let's say that quiditas means your superpower or your magic power. What would your quiditas be?
I would say my superpower is that I need people around me. I think my superpower is that I have no need to be the guy. I want to be among the guys and gals. But what I'm most proud of in my life is that the one big acting award I ever won was a Drama Desk Award, which has always been the awards that mean the most to me, because they, in New York, they take into account all productions, Broadway, off-Broadway, off-Broadway, everything. And I won an award along with an ensemble of other actors for a play called The Wayside Motor Inn about 4 years ago. And it was an ensemble award. It was outstanding ensemble. And that is exactly the kind of, that's the kind of work I want to be known for, you know? And I think it's what drew me to acting to begin with, to theater to begin with, was community. Yeah, I would say that my superpower is that I want community. I want community more than anything else. I want my artistic successes to be about community and ensemble. And I think because of that, I realize greater joy than a lot of people who disdain that for individual achievement will ever experience. So that to me, I mean, maybe that's arrogant. I'm not trying to be. I fully believe that. That's my superpower, is understanding that ensemble matters more than anything else.
What's the one thing that acting did for you that you didn't expect?
I mean, to a certain extent, I never expected to be known by anybody beyond maybe a 10 block square radius in New York. I've always been politically active, and I've always had a sense of, because of my parents, was instilled in me activism and fighting the good fight. I was telling someone recently, like, literally fighting the good fight, which is such a cliche. That term was not cliche in my house. That was real. Like, my mom talked about fighting the good fight. My dad talked about fighting the good fight, like capital G, capital F. And so I think once the Americans, and particularly billions, hit, and more people got to sort of know me, I became more known. I'm still uncomfortable with saying stuff like that, but it surprised me, and it made me happy that there were organizations that would then want me to help them by lending my name, or my face, or my voice, or you know, lending my skill to do commercial or something. That was a pretty joyful and surprising development. And I work for an organization now. I'm on the board of an organization called Culture City, which is an autism awareness organization, and we transform public spaces into sensory inclusive spaces. And we signed with the NBA, which is one of my passions since I was a kid. We got 22 arenas that we've converted into sensory inclusive spaces so that people with autism or with dementia or PTSD can go to any game. They don't have to wait for sensory friendly nights. You know, we've got these, we can get into that more, but it's, and I'm working with, I'm working with Dominique Wilkins right now on an initiative that we've started with the Culture City. We're trying to build a legal defense fund for people with disabilities who need legal help. Matthew Russian, the guy who's, he's in jail for 50 years because he was pulled over for a speeding ticket, and the police officers didn't know how to handle a person with autism, and things blew up, and there are communities that need help, particularly minority communities too, when it's compounded with having a sensory issue or a disability. And so for me, this taps into the social justice stuff that I've grown up caring about so much. And I've been doing videos for an organization that's trying to register people to vote and trying to protect voting rights in states across the country. And so I guess I would say that the most surprising thing for me is that acting has actually helped me participate in a way that seems meaningful and helpful in politics, which is my other, and activism, which is my other passion.
Here's another question for you. Tell me about somebody who touched your heart and how they made your life better.
I've often said this. My mom has probably the truest moral compass of anyone I've ever met. My wife, Carolyn, comes close, at least close, if not equal. They are people who would never, who never continue to never let me get lazy about something.
My next question for you is, what's the best compliment you've ever received?
I mean, that changes, doesn't it? That changes with when I was describing, I was talking about my botany teacher, Bill George, in Washington, D.C., my science teacher, biology, botany, I think it was botany. Anyway, when he said, yeah, you can make it. I mean, that was a statement of fact, but to me, it was a compliment. And at that point in my life, I needed to hear that. Mm-hmm. If I hadn't had him, maybe someone else would have come along. I mean, maybe I had enough adrenaline, enough sense of inertia that I could have pursued it anyway. But I got so few gigs for so many years that the only thing that kept me going was every once in a while, at very strategic, opportune moments, there was some compliment. There was some, you got it, kid, or I think you're really good, or something that didn't lead to anything tangible, but was just said by someone who I admire that kept me going. Because people often ask, well, because I described like really not getting paid for 10 years to act. And they're like, well, what kept you going? And I'm just like, I didn't want to do anything else. I had really cheap rent, which is, you can't sneeze at. I had just these people every once in a while saying, no, you got it. It's just a matter of time or whatever. And so in a way, there are too many of them to name, yeah. But it was a series of people who came along at the right time. And most of them were casting directors or directors or other actors. Sometimes F. Murray Abraham, I did a reading with F. Murray Abraham. And I hadn't been paid for anything in like 2 years or something. And I did something and he was like, you are wonderful. And you know, that voice of his. And I was like, oh my God, you have just literally, if I don't work for two more years, I'm still going to be able to hang in there because F fucking Murray Abraham just told me that I'm wonderful, you know, stuff like that.
Tell me a funny story on the set or sometime during your career you'd like to share with the audience.
Well, the fake fight episode, the fake fight scene in Billions was it was one of my favorite experiences ever. I had lost my voice a couple of days before. It was just starting to come back. And you can sort of hear it when I come in the room at the very top of the scene. I'm like, thank you, my children. It sounds like a little froggy. But fortunately, Damien and I figured out as long as I keep yelling, it doesn't sound encumbered. It doesn't sound like, but if I was just trying to talk like this, so the scene lent itself to yelling. So we got lucky. I can recognize that I don't have like the full range of my voice. It all feels, and when I look at it, I'm like, oh, it's all one note, but that's okay. That was really fun. That was hilariously fun. Shooting the episode where I smashed Ari Spiros's Porsche was one of the most fun, giddy days of my life. Steve Kunkin, who plays Ari Spiros, has become a great friend of mine, but we barely knew each other before the show started. And we got a whole day out in New Jersey where we were smashing cars and screaming and yelling. And just like, I was describing this to somebody. It was like, we were kind of like 12-year-old boys. You know how young kids sometimes when they get excited, they sort of lose their breath. And they can't quite finish sentences. We were talking like that. That was fun. In a general sense, I'll say that backstage on set at Billions is a lovely place to be. The cast and crew are all great. There's a group of us that cast that are really tight, and we have, you know, text threads. Everyone's checking in on everybody else through the pandemic and the quarantines. And it's just, it's a good, I think I probably sort of lost track of your question, but I'll just in general, I'll say that days on set are wonderful because it's such a funny group of people. Mm-hmm. And everybody top down, Damien and Paul, although I rarely work with Paul, but Damien and Maggie and Dave Costable plays Wags. Like, it's just fun. And you joke around and give each other shit. And there are no divas. And so it's just fun to be there. I guess I'd say that the most sort of surprising thing about being on set in a show like Billions, which is about such awful people, toxic, power hungry people, is that it is so easygoing and lovely and supportive. Like a family. It's really like a family.
Just a couple more questions before I let you go. What's one common myth about acting you'd like to debunk right now?
Common myth about my profession. That actors are coddled, that actors are, that acting is not real work. That theater is not real work. That TV is not real work. People work fucking hard. And that's tied into what I often get because I'm very political on the Twitter. I get a lot of stay in your lane, stick to reading lines. And inherent in that is that you're a mental midget, and you really need to, you don't have the brain capacity to really think about these issues, actor. And that drives me crazy. It's easy to marginalize actors and people in the entertainment industry, and it shouldn't be because we work fucking hard.
Yeah, very true.
And most of us work fucking hard with no compensation for years, years, decades in my case, and a lot of people's cases, and stuck with it, and then something maybe hit, and now you're doing okay, and that's something people forget about.
And my last question for today is, what does the future hold for Kelly O'Coin?
Oscars, Emmys, Tonys, maybe I don't know. I want, and what I've always wanted, is just to keep working. I hope the future holds for me is work. I want to keep working. I want to do work that interests me and challenges me. I think one of the things that I'm learning is that when I get to do, I've been lucky to be able to do like a play a year during the off season. And that's great because that's still my first love. And that's my base, theater, live theater. Breathing the same air as everybody in a room. And that's part of what the problem is right now. Mm-hmm. When we can get back to doing theater again, what I've realized more than ever is that I want to work on challenging stuff. I want to work on things that definitely challenge me, but also challenge the audience and might not even be received well. I want people to respond. I don't want it to be, I'm not interested right now in terms of theater in doing comfortable stuff. I would like to work on pieces that dare greatly and may fail greatly or fail horribly, but dare. That really interests me. And I did this play called Radio Island at New York Stage and Film a couple summers ago. It was a fully realized production, but we were changing even like the final performance. We had a whole new scene that was rewritten, and it's a great place up there. That it's all for process. Audiences come, but there are no reviewers, so you can't kill a show early on because it's not quite ready or anything. Mm-hmm. Liza Birkenmeyer, great playwright, and it was so thrilling to be involved with this play where she was just trying shit. And I think it was really good. I think it actually should have a life. And I hope it does. But, that solidified for me that that's the kind of stuff I want to do. So the future holds for me. I hope Carolyn and I have wonderfully happy, long lives and the people I love and am related to, and family and chosen family all have the same. But the practical sense, I hope that I get to work on some really interesting projects coming up that challenge me and the audience.
Kelly, thank you so much for joining me on the show. Before I let you go, can you take us out?
Hey, I'm Kelly O'Coin, and I'm listening to The Quiditas Factor.
Thank you for listening to The Quiditas Factor. I am Michael J. Arboy. Before I let you guys go, please visit my website at www.mikearboy.com. That's MikeArBoyet.com. And please check out the Quiditas page and go to my shop and go to Arbor Artifacts and buy a t-shirt that will help keep the show going, as well as my wife's Etsy store. That is Poem Jewelry Design. She makes wonderful jewelry. So if you're looking for something for someone, please check that out. And also, if you want to become a patron, please, by all means, check out my Patreon page. Click on the button on the website and become a patron for like $1 a month or $5 a month. You really help the show going, and I'll give you some secret tips and stuff that didn't end up in the broadcast. Little tidbits of knowledge information that you might like. Please come back next Tuesday for an all-new episode of The Quiditas Factor. Thank you for listening.
Thanks so much for listening to The Quiditas Factor with Michael J. Arboway. We'll catch you next time.